On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into Jalen Brunson's dominant playoff run. Can the Knicks do this again? And finally, where is Giannis going to end up? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh. The finals are over. The New York Knicks are champions. And we've got to recap this whole thing. The Knicks win in five games, end the 53-year drought. And you know who was there for it all is my man, your man, Dan Devine. What's going on, dude?
It feels preposterous that it's over. It feels ridiculous that whatever, like 2 months ago, less than 2 months ago, we were wondering if the Knicks were going to be on the way out against the Hawks. They could not get a handle on CJ McCollum. And now, 7 weeks later or whatever it is, it's one of the most incredible postseason runs in NBA history. And the Knicks are the NBA champions for the first time in my lifetime. There will be now decades of children who will not know a world in which the Knicks have not done this. And that feels mind-blowing to me. Like my children, my 11 and 8-year-old daughters are like, oh, it's cool that they won. And I'm like, yeah. It's cool that they won, but like we grow here in Brooklyn, New York. I'm like, you don't understand. you try to give them the history lesson a little bit. And they tune that out because they're sick of hearing from me, much as I'm sure everybody else is. So let's get into our big number this week, Tom. What do you got for me? What is this week's big number?
This week's big number is 52.1%. That is the percentage of Knicks clutch points scored by one guy, Jalen Brunson. Yeah. He scored over half of their points in clutch situations. Now, clutch situations comes from NBA.com, which is final 5 minutes, game within five. Jalen Brunson scored 38 of the team's 73 points in the postseason run. This is not just the finals. This is for 2+ months. Jalen Brunson scored over half of the Knicks' points in those crunch time moments. And to put this frame on the picture, Jalen Brunson becomes the highest, the player with the most highest percentage of clutch points scored by a player on a championship team since Michael Jordan.
Pretty good company.
Since 1998, Michael Jordan with the Bulls, and 97, 2 years in which he had scored over half of the Bulls' points in clutch situations. So there you see it. In 97, Michael Jordan scored 58% of the Bulls' points in clutch scenarios, and then he did it again in 1998. And then Jalen Brunson is third place since 1997. While we have these numbers, play-by-play data, started in 1997, so that's why we don't go before then. Michael Jordan, what a time to have play-by-play data that we are able to say that he scored 58% of the Bulls' clutch points in that championship run in 1997. And Stephen Curry in 2022 had 51%, but not quite the number that Jalen Brunson had in this stretch. So, like, Dan, I mean, it's incredible that we talk about a guy who was passed by everybody in the first round, won a championship at Villanova, player of the year at Villanova, still had to play backup to Luka Doncic. We've talked ad nauseum about him going to the New York Knicks on that free agency deal. But still, I don't think anyone expected this, that in crunch time, Jalen Brunson would score over 50% on a championship team. Like, we've seen guys do this for a round or two rounds. Cade Cunningham, Donovan Mitchell this year, right around 50%. But to do it sustainably for all four rounds and doing it in the biggest moments, not just in the first three, but in the finals against Victor Wembanyama, I don't know if we have enough hyperbole to describe Jalen Brunson, the captain clutch for the Knicks. But this number right here, putting him alongside Michael Jordan in 1998, peak Michael Jordan is what we're at with Jalen Brunson in clutch situations. And you were there on the front lines for just about all of it. So what do you make of this? Like, what stands out to you from watching Jalen Brunson do this for the last 2 months?
Well, that Jordan is the top of this list and Jalen Brunson's right alongside him there. It feels, I mean, it's bonkers, but it feels right. You know, I think about game five in San Antonio and it's 45 of the 94 points that the Knicks had were Jalen Brunson. Like he created, he scored about half their points in the clinching game on the road. And so like on one level, the only other person to do that in a road closeout game in the finals is Michael Jordan in 1998, game six in Utah, another 45 on the road in a closeout game. And just even the feeling of it, setting aside the numbers, like watching Brunson close that, walk the Spurs down, close out those games. It was almost independent of what happened in the first three quarters, the first three and a half quarters. That time was going to be, he would just find a way to walk them down. And it is remarkably dislocating as a New Yorker who watched Michael Jordan do that to the Knicks over and over again. I had this thought as I'm watching it and writing about it. I'm thinking like, and it's blasphemous to some degree, like this is a Michael Jordan performance. Game five specifically, I know we're talking more broadly about the postseason writ large, but that was, it was a Jordan game, and the Knicks have never gotten those games, right? They've always been on the other side of a game like that. And so to watch that happen in real time and to watch and hear and feel Spurs fans see it coming, know it's coming. After I saw Cleveland fans feel it coming and know it was coming in the Eastern Conference Finals, after Philly fans saw it and felt it was coming before that, like, the fact that that Jalen Brunson has sort of elevated to that place, this is beyond I win clutch player of the year, right? This is like something different in terms of the expectation is, if we even give this guy a half a breath, he's going to take our hearts. Like, and that's a pretty bonkers and remarkable thing to be true, that he has been able to do that on mega usage, mega, like the funny thing, you know, as you said, you know, with the big number being 52.1%, the only surprise is that it is not larger having watched Jalen Brunson in clutch time in this postseason. And that anybody else besides OG Anunoby was scoring in the fourth quarter and close and late in these games, to do it while basically never turning the ball over, while shooting, like his efficiency numbers have all skyrocketed. I think the true shooting is well north of like 62% in those clutch situations, like in these late games. The ability to take control of that, of those games, those moments, repeatedly, consistently, to the point where it's like fundamentally the Knicks' identity was, they are never out of a game. They will always be able to come back, in large part because of him. It's remarkable. It's remarkable for a listed 6'2" point guard. I think listed is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, having been alongside Jalen Brunson for a lot of this run. And that, you know, without blazing speed and a 40-foot Steph Curry pull-up three and all that, like for him to consistently be able to generate those advantages and capitalize on them was remarkable to watch throughout. And it's as big a reason as any that the Knicks are now NBA champions.
He was unbelievable. I mean, the shot, the footwork, the placement, the touch. I even go back to the game four, when De'Aaron Fox doubled him at the end of the game.
Yep.
He missed the shot, but I remember thinking, oh, he's taken an early three here once De'Aaron doubles so that he can get an offensive rebound out of this. And now that OG's free, even if I miss this, I'm Kobe assisting this and allowing OG a free runway to the rim. So even that play, while it's not considered a make in that moment, I find that to be a clutch moment where he's a winning play, incredibly cerebral play. And I remember seeing it in real time and just thinking, once he got that double, it was like a soft double from De'Aaron Fox, and we don't have to relitigate De'Aaron Fox thing again. But in that moment, Jalen Brunson knew, all right, there's 7 seconds left on the clock here. I want to make sure that I get on, get the shot up, so I give an opportunity for my guys to take this three and sure, or to get this rebound. And sure enough, the OG Anunoby play doesn't happen without Jalen Brunson having that wherewithal to take that early three. If you look at, here's what's crazy. If you look at the Knicks clutch scoring in the postseason, you can see he's had 38 points. OG Anunoby has 22. And then no other Knicks player has more than five. Look at this list. Jalen Brunson, 38. OG Anunoby, 22. You add up everybody else, and Jalen Brunson has more than his teammates combined. And look what name is missing on that list. Karl Anthony Towns did not have a single point in clutch scenarios in this postseason run. And Dan, if you had told me before the playoffs that the Knicks would not get a single point from Karl Anthony Towns in crunch time, I think I would have said they would have been a first round out. Like, there's no way that they can be successful with their second best scorer just being giving a zero from the scoring column in those big moments. But that's how good Jalen Brunson was, and that's how elite OG Anunoby was in those moments. And I would say that there are a lot of different ways that Karl Anthony Towns was contributing in those crunch time moments that didn't have to do with him actually putting the ball in the basket, his passing, his defense, the gravity that he had. I think still he was a big time contributor and a reason why they won this NBA championship. But man, isn't that nuts that Karl Anthony Towns in the 16-3 postseason run in which Jalen Brunson had 38 points, there was zero from Karl Anthony Towns and it did not matter.
I think the thing that the other thing that stands out to me in this chart is just that Jalen Brunson can go to Josh Hart and say, "Oh, you got one. Like, I had 38 and you had one. You made one free, you missed the other free throw, but you did get the one. And you know, that's nice for you. That's thank you for that 1 point." In crunch time in the playoffs. Thank you so much for that. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the thing that's remarkable about this too is, and I mean, of course, you know, winning cures everything, right? But like, you can envision a world in which the team's other all-star, other all-NBA caliber performer is not frozen out, but essentially not really a major contributing factor in the scoring column in these close and late situations, and that being like a wedge issue in the locker room, right? Or like something that can be a dampener on the vibes, can create some tension. Zero, like, or at least publicly facing, and not anything that I heard from around the team throughout this run. Like, Karl Towns repeatedly over and over again was like, "I care about winning. I care about like us getting to like I've been to the Western Conference Finals, the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, I've gotten close before. I've never gotten over the line. I don't care if it's me. I care if it's us." And the recipe that got the Knicks, one of the things, and we talked about this before, that has made the Knicks special throughout this run is that there wasn't just one recipe, right? Like, there was, when needed, Brunson going ISO and hunting down James Harden. There was Karl Anthony Towns at the elbow being the facilitating hub and everybody running around off the ball. There was a lot of, spread pick and roll with Brunson on the handle and operating from there. There was, getting OG Anunoby off the baseline cuts. There was Mikal Bridges flashing middle, yada, yada, yada. There was many ways to skin the cat, right? You know, pun not intended. But when it got down to when we need it, when we got to have it absolutely, everybody understood, like, it's Jalen's ball and we're going to play it through that. And Mikal Bridges, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but Mikal Bridges had said something later in the finals that was like, we understand, like, Jalen has a great basketball IQ, a great understanding of what the right play is. But a lot of times he's going to look at it and say, like, the right play is me shooting. And like, yeah, the numbers kind of, they indicate to you that it's not a bad plan. It certainly worked out well for the Knicks. And the thing that I will come back to, and there's a million of them. I know we talked sort of about like the plays that'll stand out in your brain, the ways it'll all sort of work out, that you've got Brunson consistently. There were all these versions of him coming through in those moments. And sometimes it's, against the Cavs when they're down 22 in game one, the fourth quarter of the Eastern Conference Finals. And it's all right. I am hunting. I have to do this. We didn't do it to this point. I have to do it. And the shot making from all angles of the backboard and all depths of field, and some of it's pull up threes and some of it's at the rim and some of it's like a 14-foot floater leaning away. And you're like, how is all the shot making of this touch, this unbelievable touch, they're down in, down at one point, I believe, late in game one in San Antonio when they're making the comeback there. And it's Brunson getting the offensive rebound to be able to generate a new possession, like fighting among the trees, tapping it out, getting the offensive rebound, relocating to the corner. And I think that's one thing, as I say, relocation here. The other name on that list of, who generated the most of the points in clutch time there that you had was Steph Curry. And I think the thing that this postseason run, and particularly that chunk of it that was Karl-Anthony Towns at the elbow and Jalen Brunson running off, setting flex screens, coming off and curling into a catch. I don't know if there's anybody in the league right now besides Stephen Curry that can stress a defense in as many ways as Jalen Brunson can right now, where it's, if it's me in the pick and roll and I'm attacking that way, that's fine. If it's pulling up for three in Victor Wembanyama's face, you got to honor me out there. You got to send the second guy, right? In the close and late situations, because you're worried about it. Try to get the ball out of my hands. You're going to blitz me because you want to get the ball out so I can, and then we can play 4-on-3 out of that. I can set those off ball screens. You're going to have two come to me. OG will, you know, slice in and get a dunk out of that. There are all these things that, like, the course of this postseason, many, you know, heroes and stars for the Knicks. All of it, though, stemmed from the attention that Jalen Brunson got and demanded, and the way he would punish you if you didn't give it to him. And I think there's something to be said for, you know, combine that with the off-court component of all of those guys are not complaining. All of those guys understand this is how we get open. It's how we get looks. It's how we generate buckets. And there's something too, Mike Brown, after the Eastern Conference Finals, saying the leaders he's been around that Steph Curry, that Jalen Brunson reminds him of, are Tim Duncan and Steph Curry. I think some of that's all wrapped up. Like, if we play through me, everyone gets well. And yeah, I'm going to be the one scoring most of the points at the end of the game because you want the ball in my hands. But also, we're going to have less clutch time than we used to because we're going to be blowing people out for large chunks of this, because when we play through me like that, everybody eats. And so I think Brunson comes out of this series with a dramatically elevated profile, certainly with a dramatically elevated standing in the league. And I think that's, to me, what I will remember is, like, there were a lot of ways that he got to that place. And a lot, it's not just those clutch shots, although that's a huge part of it. He showed a capacity to impact the game in all different sorts of ways on offense in a way that very, very, very few people in the league can.
We talked a lot about how the Spurs in 2014, just the beautiful game, the beautiful basketball, summertime, as Jackie McMullen at ESPN so brilliantly wrote that story. Greg Popovich said, I want this to feel, our offense to feel like summertime. The sun's out, you're moving the ball around, you're just playing like kids. And that's what the Knicks did for so much of this series and so much of this postseason run. But I can't stress enough how anti-Spurs this number, 52%, is, because when I did this number, when I did this study, time and time again, the Spurs had the lowest percentage of their leading scorer coming, or their clutch points coming from a single player during these champion runs. And I should just stress this. This is 51% among champions, the only player since 1997 that had a higher percentage of team points scored by one player is Jalen Brunson and Michael Jordan. So among championship teams, the Spurs continually had, you know, Ginobili at like 23%, Tim Duncan at 24%, and then you had Jalen Brunson in the last moments of the game being the guy to take the shot. And this isn't like a blip. This is a guy who's already won Clutch Player of the Year, the new NBA award, and has been top five in the last 4 years. So, Dan, like, when you're more clutch by many measures than just about everybody that we've seen in the last 20 years in this 21st century of NBA basketball, that includes Dirk, that includes Kobe Bryant, that includes LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was at 48% last year. It's just, it's mind-blowing. And I think, you know, there's one play that sticks out to me is that corner three from Jalen Brunson. And not just the corner three, it's the play before that that he hit from, I think it was OG Anunoby passing the ball. The play before that, he takes like eight defenders with him, it felt like, because of all the gravity that Jalen Brunson has. He's taking so much attention. And then when he kicks out, swing, then all the defense doesn't know what to do. They have to go in rotation. And then the offensive rebound is so critical, because then he gets wide open for the corner three. And that's all because of Jalen Brunson's work on the previous possession. How much gravity he had and all the attention was because they have a panic attack every time he gets the ball in clutch situations. So, Dan, is there any other play that sticks out to you when it comes to Jalen Brunson's clutch performance this postseason that we want to hit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a million of them, but I think the versions all stick into my brain are those shots in late against San Antonio, like the one leg Dirk fadeaway he hits over, you know, bumps off Julian Champagne and steps back and drops it in. And like the sort of unbelievable touch he kept showing on those like full speed runners. The one, you know, I mean, the pull up threes on Wemby are, you know, that's iconic. Yeah. And that's or the when he drew him out in game five. And like dusted past him, bumped him off, like maybe like a little shot in the liver with the forearm, ref didn't call it, but creates just enough space and like plays off 2 feet over and over again. You hear these Villanova guys play off 2 feet. Mike Brown talks about the importance of playing off 2 feet. Brunson gets into the lane on 2 feet. It's able to shift just enough to his right to get past Wembanyama's arm on the block. But the one that I want to like, it's important in the context of winning the title, but it's the one that's going to stick in my brain is in game five. They've made the run. They're on top. Dylan Harper comes down and hits like, I think like a 9 or 10 footer to get it tied at 88. And it's like, there's a moment of relief. Like, okay, we're not out of this yet. Like, yes, the it's happening again. The Knicks are coming back again. Brunson's doing it again. But there's like a minute left, a minute 10 left. It's tied. We got a shot at this. We stemmed the tide a little bit. And Brunson just gets the ball and immediately brings it up, doesn't wait for a screen, doesn't call up a screen, or isn't waiting for, you know, we're going to drain 18 seconds off the clock. He just goes, dusts Steph Castle, who defended Brunson about as well as anybody could. Although, yeah. how many series now have we said that as Jalen Brunson winds up averaging 32 a game in the series? But dusts Steph Castle going to his left. Gets to the paint. Wembanyama's like maybe a step further back. I think he's like worried about Mitch Robinson on the lob or on the offensive rebound or whatever, but like doesn't quite get out. Or also maybe just a little tired because of how much the Knicks made Wembanyama work in this series. And he gets 2 feet in the paint and then he gets, but it's a floater from the left elbow. He's at the foul line and he shoots a 12-foot floater going full speed with Steph Castle on his hip. Cash. And so the breath of fresh air, the exhale that the Spurs had was like 4 seconds. And then again, Brunson just did it again. And now they're down again and they got to climb the mountain again. And that temperamentally, like energetically, the vibe of what Brunson brought to the Knicks in this, that to me is that, oh, okay, you think you're safe. You think it's over. It's just getting started. I'm going to do it again, and you are going to have to stop it again and again and again. And to do it again at that height with that athletic profile against these defenses, against the best, one of the two best defenses in the NBA over the course of the full season, San Antonio, with size everywhere and length everywhere and athleticism everywhere, and it did not matter. That I will remember that. Like that, to me, is Jalen Brunson mentality. You know, you think you're safe. But, you know, it's a horror movie and I'm coming back again. Like so that's what it sticks out in my brain.
Yeah. The thing that is amazing about that play too, Wemby didn't even contest it. If you watch it again,
Wemby didn't
even get a hand up. He was caught in no man's land where he's coming out to contest the shot and then doesn't even get a hand up. So he's not even deterring Jalen Brunson from making that floater, which he's shown time and time again he can hit. And is doing it so many times in this series that Wemby doesn't rotate over. Maybe he's exhausted. Maybe he doesn't want to fully commit. But he's 7'18". Get your hand up. You know? And it's those things where Jalen has the ability to read the defense, understand the circumstances, and have this proprioception of just knowing where everybody is, and I'm going to get to this floater, and he's not even going to contest. So it's the conditioning. We can talk about Rick Brunson and the practicing and the repetition that he had over the years, but he just didn't seem 6'2 in that moment. He felt like a giant, like a New York giant in that moment where every time you saw him, you're like, I am fully confident that he's going to hit this shot. And the numbers bear it out. He had 14 shots in this postseason run that were considered super clutch. Clutch squared is what Inpredictable.com they're describing these plays. They quantify basically which shots have a swing in win probability so much that it registers 99th percentile or higher in clutch situations. And there were 14 such shots by Jalen Brunson in this postseason run, and he went 7 of 14. The rest of the NBA is shooting 40% effective field goal percentage in these super clutch shots, and he was at 54% when you incorporate the extra value of the three-pointer. The 14 shots in super clutch situations is the most for a champion since Michael Jordan, and he shot 5 of 14 on those shots. Jalen Brunson shot 7 of 14. So even if you want to just narrow it down and zero in on the most clutch shots possible in those postseason runs, Jalen Brunson took more than anybody that won a championship, and he also made more than anybody that won a championship dating back to 1997. So Jalen Brunson is just... what can you say? Like, this is where numbers really helpful, because I think Knicks fans feel this. Spurs fans feel this. The Cavs fans feel this. Is Philly, they all feel, wait a minute. How, this guy was just on another level, Michael Jordan-esque. And there you go with the numbers. 52% of clutch points scored by the Knicks came from one guy, Jalen Brunson, more than any of his teammates combined. Absurd.
Yeah, and to put a button on that point, you don't think of him like Jordan because he's not 6'6", right? You don't think of him like some of these other elite players and all-time great scorers because he's not above the rim dunking, right? But what those guys all shared was an ability to elevate in those moments that matter the most, and to bring everyone with them. And one of the things that I think a lot about, I was in the post game after the title celebration, Karl Towns comes in, and I just basically asked, because I was going to be writing about Brunson for Yahoo Sports, real original angle, right, about Jalen Brunson after that kind of game. But just ask, like, basically, you've been here step for step for them the whole way. Like, what have you seen from him? What do you know about him now that you didn't know before, kind of thing? And he said, like, the thing that, you know, for him to welcome us here into the organization and trust that we were here for him means a lot. Like, that understanding of, I'm Karl-Anthony Towns. I was the number one pick in the draft. I'm a 3-time All-NBA player. I've made like 6 All-Star teams, whatever. I was brought here for him. And I get that. And now I get why I was brought here for him. And I'm cool with understanding that I'm here. He's not here for, you know, they're not here for me. We're here for him. And for him to open the door for us like that and to kick it down the way he has, it means the world. They all talk about him like that. Mikal Bridges is like, I don't want to be anywhere in the world but alongside him in the backcourt. Like, Josh Hart makes the jokes, but all of these guys are like, we understand we're here for him. And that can put a lot of noses out of joint in a different situation, understanding that it's not about you, it's about everybody else. The story of the Knicks is about the collective playmaking that they got to, the way they elevated on both ends of the floor. That story, though, starts and ends with Jalen Brunson, and for the ball to be in his hands in crunch time and everybody to be cool with it and understand it and do what they can to augment that, that is as big a reason as any is where the Knicks landed, how the Knicks have landed where they got.
Yeah, Jalen Brunson, I mean, they had 5 clutch games in all 5 games. The Spurs had a lead in these moments, crunch time moments in all 5 games. And yet Jalen Brunson is the biggest reason why they are champions, and they're going to have their parade on Thursday. It's going to be nuts. I can't wait to see what goes down in Manhattan, but Dan, they want to throw another parade next year. I know a bunch of people who are unfortunately not going to be able to make it to this year's parade. And I keep saying, like, there's always next year. Like, the Knicks, it's usually a different connotation that there's always next year. But I do think that the Knicks have a good chance of being champions again in 2027. So it won't, with this team, anything is possible. I just suspect that we won't see another 53-year drought after this one. Dan, 3 little numbers coming up. We're going to talk about the chances for the Knicks to repeat something that the previous 8 champions have not been able to do. So we're going to look ahead at the Knicks' ability to do this again next year and what needs to happen for that to occur. So coming up right after the break. right. The Knicks are champions. Jalen Brunson scored over half of the team's clutch points. It's only the third time that we've seen a player do that since 1997, that a player has scored over half a team's clutch points en route to a championship. Jalen Brunson, what can you say about that guy? We just spent close to half an hour talking about that. We've got other things that we need to hit with this Knicks team that are now the champions. What are your three little numbers? Let's start with the first one, Dan, on this New York Knicks team trying to repeat.
Yeah, so the framing idea is basically like, what's the argument for them being able to have a chance? I believe they have a chance of repeating, right? So when we understand, as Tom mentioned on the other side of the break, like, hasn't happened since the 2017-18 Warriors. Like, the odds are against it in this parity of opportunity era, right? But if you were making the argument, where would you start? And I would start with my first little number, 74.6%, which is the share of the Knicks' minutes from this postseason played by Jalen Brunson, Karl-Anthony Towns, OG Anunoby, Mikal Bridges, Josh Hart, and Deuce McBride, the top six there. All six of those guys are on guaranteed contracts for next season. They will be back. None of them ended the postseason injured. They should all be healthy and good to go starting in training camp next year, all things considered. Both Landry Shamet and Mitchell Robinson, two of the Knicks' important bench players, are unrestricted free agents, so they might not be back. Especially the Knicks are about projected to be about $16.5 million under the second apron right now. So the finances could be tricky, especially if somebody, you know, makes a big offer for Mitch Robinson, which could happen. If they do bring back those guys, though, the returning rotation minutes would be up to about 87%. Jose Alvarado has a $4.5 million player option for next year. We'll see if they decide to tear something up and get something new done there, if they could bring him back. Jordan Clarkson is an unrestricted free agent, was on the minimum this year. Maybe he sees something else elsewhere. If they bring those guys back, it's up to 95%. So that kind of, there's a pathway here to almost complete continuity on the in terms of the rotation that just won the championship. Continuity in and of itself does not guarantee anything. The Thunder brought back about 95% of their minutes from their title team this year, according to John Schumann at NBA.com, his continuity rankings. They went out in the conference finals. It's not a guarantee of anything. But if you're looking to make a repeat case, I think you start there. This team brings back the entire core, the entire starting five, its main reserve. It could bring back more than that. And if you're going to start anywhere, the idea that they know how to play together, they've gotten to the mountaintop now, and they bring all those guys back healthy on guaranteed contracts, long-term deals, it gives you a pretty good starting point.
Yeah, and that number of getting back 75% of those the minutes that you mentioned with those players, and Mitchell Robinson, like you said, integral part of this championship run, a lot of those crunch time minutes defensively, he was subbed in place of Karl-Anthony Towns. The offensive rebounds, the second chance opportunities, when you have a guy who is very low turnover, Jalen Brunson, you're going to get a lot of shots up and they're not going to hit every time. And having a guy like Mitchell Robinson, Landry Shamet to hit those threes, taking advantage of those extra opportunities, it's huge, but everyone has a price. And we've seen this time and time again, whether it's the Isaiah Hartenstein with the Knicks, deciding like, I love you guys, but like, you guys can only offer me so much and I'm going to go get my big payday. It would be hard to blame Mitchell Robinson and Landry Shamet if they decided, look, I got my championship ring. You guys are under a tough apron situation and the cap is what it is. And I want to go find a generational help generations to come with the bag. So they might not come back, but man, I can't remember a time that I felt this good about the health of a team and the cap of the team bringing all these guys back. I wrote about this week, is that the New York Knicks become 7 out of the last 8 champions that didn't have a star player miss any games in their championship run. That is such a big part of this conversation with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Yes, bringing back their large core last year, but Jalen Williams paid that championship tax, as I like to call it, is that the bodies were just dealing with a lot more mileage on their tires. And I think that's a big reason why I feel pretty good about the Knicks, is that they only have 3 losses in this championship run, which means they had a lot of time off between series and they weren't, you know, run down nearly as much to the bone as you would see from other championship teams over the last few years. And so I don't think that this can be discounted, is the medical staff, the training staff led by Casey Smith from Nico Harrison, when he let go Casey Smith and Jalen Brunson and traded away Luka Doncic, the Knicks, as much as anybody, have capitalized on the scraps from the Nico Harrison era. And they have a great training staff led by Casey Smith, who is the team trainer for Team USA. They just have a lot of reasons to feel optimistic about them having enough miles and left in the tank to do this again next year in ways that past champions have not been able to do over the last 8 years.
Yeah, and they're all, I think they're confident, maybe not in terms of these guys becoming immediate major contributors, but like Tyler Kolek took a jump forward in the early part of the season. He basically left the rotation once Jose Alvarado got there. But if you need more minutes from him, I mean, he played fourth quarter minutes in the NBA Cup championship game against the Spurs and looked pretty good when he was doing that. Like Ariel Hakpoorti, when they needed him to sort of come in and spell Mitchell Robinson, gave good minutes for most of the season. And then like in the finals, he played, I think, 2 minutes, but had a block at the rim and, you know, came through, was ready when called upon. You know, Mo Diawara is it's going to be interesting to see if they can keep him, rookie from this year. There's like the Gilbert Arenas situation, second round pick, non-bird rights. Like somebody could make an offer for him and get him if they want to. We'll see. But like they've got some young guys that they feel pretty good about. They think they might have an opportunity to step into some more minutes if need be. But the main thing is the main guys. They're all coming back and they're all prime age guys that exit the season healthy. So reason to be optimistic there. Another reason number is our second little number this week, which is 108.7. That's how many points per 100 possessions the Knicks allowed from mid-January through the end of the NBA Finals, according to pbpstats.com. 108.7 defensive rating over the final 5 months of the season, a 61-game sample. That was the best defense in the NBA for what wound up being, what, two-thirds of the season, essentially. Didn't get as much publicity as the offense because, you know, it's easier and more fun to talk about Jalen Brunson in the clutch or Kat stretching the floor and making plays from the elbow, OG two-hand dunking on baseline drives and, you know, shooting 70% true shooting or whatever. But that was the backbone here of this Knicks run. Every team they played in the postseason wound up scoring significantly below their season averages. The Hawks, this is all from Cleaning the Glass, 12.2 points per 100 under their regular season scoring average. The Sixers, 5.9 points per 100 under their regular season offensive rating. Cavs, 17.3 points per 100 under their offensive rating in the regular season. And then the Spurs dropped from 120.3 in the regular season to 108.3 in the finals. Shooting variance, you can call it that. You can say three-point luck, you can call it that. You can say it's turnovers, you can say it's injuries, you can say whatever. The Knicks consistently were able to execute the game plans that were out in front of them to the point where they had, again, statistically, the best defense in the NBA for the last 5 months of the season. So if you're looking for another reason for optimism next year, more continuity in this system, more reps with these guys, knowing what Mike Brown wants of them, what defensive coordinator Brendan O'Connor wants of them, and how to execute it together, proof of concept that they could do it against the best teams they were playing at the highest levels. If you have a feel like you've got a baseline of top five caliber defense with the heights they can get to on the offensive end, it's a pretty high platform to build from.
Isn't it nuts that we're talking about this with the Karl Anthony Towns and Jalen Brunson led team, Dan?
Yes, absolutely. And to that point, so two things about that. One, Karl Anthony Towns, I think we can put to bed the idea that he's a bad defensive player. Like, it's a version of the Jokic argument, I suppose, and we haven't put that to bed, so maybe I'm being overly optimistic when I say it. But because he doesn't block a lot of shots, although he had more blocks and steals over the course of this postseason than I think he'd had in previous, his rates for that were much better than they were in previous postseasons. And the defensive rim, field goal percentage allowed at the rim when he's the closest defender, that kind of rim deterrence stat, Kat doesn't look great in that. He's never going to be Rudy Gobert in that kind of state. But like, the ability to play higher coverage, be up on pick and rolls, to be able to use the length and the wingspan as he retreats, understanding how he would have to work in combination with OG, with Mikal Bridges, with Josh Hart. And, you know, he proved pretty definitive. And then obviously the defensive rebounding was elite. So like he proved, I think, over the course of the season, pretty definitively, you can have an excellent defense with him as your five back there. It's about how you orchestrate it, how you run it. You can't just run deep drop against everybody and hope for the best. You've got to have different ways of playing. The Brunson component, again, we go back to Steph, right? Was When did Steph Curry go from like defensive liability to guy you could really bank on? It was when they really figured out that like high hedge coverage, right? Obviously, he had to get stronger. He had to work on his base and his core and be able to hold up against some of the hunt, the mismatch hunting. But they also had to figure out how to get him out of that. And it's that when the you're coming up in the pick and roll, it's he hedges high, his teammate goes under, and he's able to scurry back and get to where he wants to be, keep him out of harm's way. That's what the Knicks were doing with Brunson. And they were able to execute it again at a high level. Brunson, when he was switched onto a ball handler, sometimes he'd have to just take the hits. And he's strong as hell. He was able to do that. He's going to give up some shots over the top, but he can hold his own in a back down, right? But a lot of times it's just, can you execute the coverage? Give me the high tag, get out of there, hustle back, don't leave an opening. And then with the length everybody else has around it, can we, so like all of which is to say, don't look at the roster and tell me, oh, those two guys can't do it, so we're going to be bad. Find a way to do it. And that's where Mike Brown and that coaching staff, I think, deserves so much credit, because you're absolutely right. Everybody, pundits included, you know, hands up accountability, looked at it and said, that's going to be the pain point. And then over the course of the season, it doesn't get talked about as much, but that became, if not the best, statistically the best, but arguably, that's a top five defense in the NBA over the course of the last like 5-6 months of the year. And it, you know, that provided the stability for everything else to play up. And it came up again and again in the playoffs as these elite offensive players, excellent players, were not able to get to what they wanted to consistently.
I mean, think about all the amazing defenders that the Spurs have. When you have Stephon Castle, you've got Wemby, obviously defensive player of the year, like runaway favorite for defensive player of the year heading into next year for the next decade. And they were so good defensively throughout this postseason run. Their defensive rating was at 105.6, meaning they allowed just 105.6 points every 100 possessions in this postseason run. Jalen Brunson on the floor, the defensive rating for the New York Knicks, 105.5. So they were better yeah. with Jalen Brunson on the floor defensively, allowing fewer points by a hair than the San Antonio Spurs with Victor Wembanyama in this postseason run, which, by the way, the Spurs were the second best defense in the postseason by points allowed per 100 possessions, and the Knicks were number one. And a big reason why is because, like you said, the way that Mike Brown and O'Connor and the team was able to figure out how do we keep Jalen Brunson out of the actions and still not taxing him defensively where he's not able to be our leader down in crunch time, it was remarkable. The fact that they had a better defensive rating with Jalen Brunson on the floor than the San Antonio Spurs did as a team. So incredible. What's your third little number?
Third and final little number, we're going to bring it back up to the top. It's plus 20.5, and that was the Knicks' net rating in the clutch during the regular season, according to NBA.com's numbers. Plus 20.5 net rating in crunch time games. So that's, as you said earlier, points scores within 5 points in the final 5 minutes. Plus 20.5 was the third best net rating in the clutch in the league, behind only the Lakers and the Thunder. And I'm bringing this up because we can look at Jalen Brunson's performance in the clutch in the playoffs and say, all right, but that's only a handful of games, right? You can look at the Knicks' performance as a team in the playoffs and say, handful of games, pretty small sample. And clutch stats are pretty notoriously finicky that way, right? You're dealing necessarily with only a sliver of the game, and you know, one shot here, one turnover there, one three-shot foul there can really skew the sample, right? So like that doesn't necessarily remain sticky year to year. But the Knicks had that performance, the clutch performance in the postseason. They had that clutch performance in the regular season. And it goes back to last season, too. Over the past two seasons, regular season and playoff combined, the Knicks are 53-32 in those close and late situations. 624 winning percentage, 51 win pace over the course of an 82-game slate, just in clutch time. Now, again, you can look at it and say, that's only whatever, like 350, 400 total minutes. Not necessarily dispositive of anything. Or you can say, if they're consistently winning 60-plus percent of their games in those situations, regular and postseason, and we've now have the example of kind of no different levels of competition, different elite opponents, yada, yada, maybe the formula, Jalen Brunson in these close games late with a defense that is not going to be able to be easily, you know, exploited, it can work. We just saw it work to the tune of a title. I think there's reason to believe that it can work to the tune of at least keeping you in that conversation moving forward. So yeah, there's the Brunson specific component of it, but you zoom out to the team's success in those moments and the team's overall point differential and net rating in those moments. It seems like they've figured out something that works.
Yeah. All of it just makes me feel like they're well suited to withstand the rigors of the repeat that we saw from the previous seven champions. As I've written about, is so much of this is injury luck going their way, not just in this postseason run, but next season, having the ability to bounce back after this and having the legs to win those clutch games like you saw in this postseason. And I don't know how much more we can look at Jalen Brunson and say, yeah, I don't think he's got another level to go. You know, like Mike Brown just had his first season with the New York Knicks and won the championship in his first season. And so the idea that like this is the ceiling of this New York Knicks team, they can't get more clutch. They can't get more healthier than you saw this year where they had zero games lost due to injury from Jalen Brunson, who left a game early in this postseason with the knee, or in the finals rather, with the knee injury, and then came back. OG missed two games. He's not quite a star, not an all-star, not an all-NBA player, three-time all-defensive player, and for much of that series was the best player on the Knicks. But still, I think there's another level that this Knicks team can get to. And Karl-Anthony Towns, again, no clutch points in this entire postseason run, so there is some meat left on the bone. And I don't think when you have a guy as clutch as Jalen Brunson, and I wouldn't say it's a clutch gene. It's just I think he's prepared for these moments and can get the footwork down that he can get these shots and hit them at such a ridiculous percentage that I don't know if there's I think it's like Michael Jordan and him is the ability to hit these tough shots continually. And now that they've had another season where they know that they can win a championship, I think the betting markets have them as like the third or fourth shortest odds to win the championship. I get it because the Giannis factor looms large over this, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment here. But the Knicks, they're going to have a really good shot at winning the championship here. And for all the reasons we described, they're getting a lot of minutes back. They were healthier in this postseason run than they were in years past because of Casey Smith and their training staff. And when you have a guy like Jalen Brunson who organizes so much for your crunch time abilities, they're going to have an easier job closing out these games and getting back to this place than I think we normally would expect with a guy this clutch. So any last thoughts here as we close the book?
Yeah, I want to. It's a point you brought up. I forget how many episodes ago, but it's something that I think is interesting in that discussion of, okay, the Knicks just steamrolled everybody to a championship, but they enter next season with, I think, as you said, the fourth highest odds of winning the championship next year. And I wrote about this a little bit in a big kind of like wrap up column at Yahoo Sports about the way the Knicks were built and their roster. I called them kind of like a roster building miracle of all the little things that had to go right to get to this point. It's a great big piece. I think it came out all right. Go read it. But the point of the idea is, it doesn't shock me to find out that the Knicks were behind OKC, behind San Antonio, behind Boston in those odds, because as you had talked about, you looked at the study of what's the most relevant sample. Is it, you know, post All-Star break? Is it pre All-Star break? Is it the first half of the season? Is it the second half of the season? And as you had looked at it and you said, the most relevant sample is the whole thing. It's the 82 game sample, right? And so the Knicks, for that 82 game sample, were something like the fifth best team in the NBA this year, right? They were a 53 win team, somewhere around, I think, fifth or sixth in net rating. They were not, you know, top two, top three on either side of the ball. And then for 19 games, they were as good as any team has ever looked. And so, you know, this is Vegas or the Sharps or whoever sort of favoring or privileging the 82 game sample over the 19 game sample, right? And I understand that. I think the thing that's I'm fascinated to learn as we head into next season is, did the Knicks figure something about themselves out in that 19 game sample, in the way that they played over the last 2 months, that can be carried over in terms of the style, the approach, how we diversify the offense, when we go to certain things, yada, yada, yada. And so are they a different team heading into next season than they were in that previous 82-game sample? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if they know the answer to that. I'm going to be very interested to find out, because if the answer to that winds up being yes, then I think we might wind up looking back and saying, you know, that those preseason odds did undervalue them a little bit. But it also very well could be it was two magic months, and then they go back to, you know, the slipper comes off, Cart turns back into a pumpkin, and oh well, they're just the fifth best team in the NBA again, which all things considered wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah, well, banners fly forever. Flags fly forever, banners hang forever, I think is really what the metaphor there is. So I would say the Knicks fans would be okay, totally happy, just fire up some YouTube clips of Jose Alvarado in the 2025-26 NBA Finals, and a lot of the Huck Porty press conferences, and they'll be fine if they don't win it again next year. But they do have a really good shot. Just real quick before we go to Giannis, Dan, you were awesome during this postseason run covering the Knicks, covering the East, and then all the writing that you did covering this team behind the scenes. Just want to give you a shout out, man. That was awesome. Doesn't get appreciated enough how hard it is to do on deadline, trying to do this night in and night out, on boots on the ground. So thank you, Dan, for not just on this show, but man, the words that you wrote this postseason, right up there with the New York Knicks.
Oh, thank you very much. That's too kind. Now get out of here before I start crying on camera. Let's get to the next segment.
We're going to talk Giannis. This time last year, there was some chatter about Giannis potentially joining the New York Knicks. I don't think we have to talk about that anymore, but we do have to talk about Giannis now that the Knicks have won the championship and we're heading into the NBA draft on Tuesday. Lots of storylines to get into. We're going to hit them after the break. All right, so Bill Simmons just sat down with Doc Rivers, and normally I'd just be like, oh, you know, Doc Rivers, he's just talking, like this is what Doc Rivers does. And then I'm remembering, like, no, he just coached Giannis Antetokounmpo. I do want to hear what he has to say about what Giannis, his true intentions, or what he wants to do, or what is big in Giannis's world, because he just coached him like 2 months ago. And so it was a really interesting conversation with Doc. A lot of things to jump into, but one thing he talked about was Miami. Does it make sense for Miami to go all in for Giannis, given that it would gut the roster with Tyler Hero going back to Milwaukee, where he's from, Jaime Jaquez potentially, Khalil Ware potentially, and basically you would have very little in the terms of what we talked about with Jalen Brunson, a closer in Tyler Hero, who up until Dylan Harper had the best finals scoring that we have seen as a rookie, and now could be a principal piece going back to Milwaukee in a potential Giannis trade. And Miami has some draft pick situation, some things to figure out. When I look at the Miami Heat, I don't worry about this at all. Like, I don't worry about the rest of the supporting cast and having enough pieces around Giannis and Bam Adebayo, considering that the Miami Heat, they have done this so many times, including the finals run, where you would be like, nah, I don't know if they have enough. And then Jimmy Butler and a bunch of cast-offs from everywhere else and Bam Adebayo win the East twice. And I think when you look at Eric Spoelstra and Pat Riley, Adam Simon, Andy Ellisberg, the way that they've been able to create supporting cast out of thin air, I have no issues about them putting Tyler Hero and Jaime Jaquez in a deal for Giannis Antetokounmpo. I don't worry about the gut tax, but it's a big reason why the kitchen sink deals, the blockbuster deals that we've seen historically, they haven't panned out nearly as well as all of the hoopla when we talk about Paul George and Kawhi Leonard going to the Clippers, or if it's Damian Lillard going to the Milwaukee Bucks. There's so many times where the gut tax is very real, and that we should spend some time wondering if mortgaging your future and putting in those players to get Giannis Antetokounmpo is really worth it. I think for the Miami Heat and their organization and their player development that we've seen time and time again, I have less concerns about that when it comes to Giannis. Other teams, maybe. Does Orlando trade Paolo Banchero for Giannis? I would do that. But they do have to have the right pieces around them. But for me, Dan, in the Giannis sweepstakes, I have probably less concern than just about the conventional wisdom when it comes to putting the right pieces around Giannis and Bam Adebayo in that trade. I would make that trade if I were the Miami Heat. And they certainly, given the reporting, they certainly think that Giannis is worth it.
Well, yeah, it's also the question is, what are you gutting, right? It's one thing if you're gutting a championship team to reload. This would be a team that's won 37 and 43 games the last 2 years, you know, a perennial play-in team. And the last time that they were able to be in the play-in and then advance out of it was when they had Jimmy Butler, and he don't work there no more, right? So the idea of, I think if anyone's going to have a problem with including Tyler Hero and Jaime Jaquez in the deal, it's the Bucks. My guess is that the reporting that I've seen, you know, I think it was Brian Windhorst that mentioned this. I know Jake Fisher, our pal, had mentioned like the idea that they might not be particularly enamored with a package that is like, or a concept, a deal construct that is built around Tyler Hero, Jaime Jaquez, you know, maybe Kalel Ware and one or two picks. So, I mean, because you imagine if they loved that, this would be done already, right? You know, why wait if you liked what was on the table for you?
Well, they probably want to wait to see if other teams can trump the offer. Not to say that it's not a good offer, but like I can understand the leverage of like, let's wait until draft day before we pull the trigger on any one of these trades. But point well taken that like if they loved this, if they were enamored with Tyler Hero, they would have said, wait, you're going to put Tyler Hero into the deal? Yeah, yes. Like that hasn't happened, right? Obviously.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, from the Heat's perspective, I think it makes total sense where you're saying like they're thinking, let's get the centerpiece, and then we will build out around that. If I mean, they were already in a situation where it's like, well, man, what are we going to do? How do we play Tyler Hero and Norm Powell together? It's like, well, if one of them's gone, then great. No, oh yeah, one of our answers at the guard spot is Norm Powell. Yeah, we like him. He was like an all-star. That's great. You know, there's ways for them to solve the problem, but for Milwaukee, yeah, I think the bigger question is just, are you waiting to see if somebody, you know, it's like, let's get the best and finals in, guys. We've got, you know, a week ahead of the draft. We want to have this done. I thought a very interesting note again from our pal Jake, let me find their exact quote here, is that the Bucks continue to signal to rival teams and agents that they plan to have as many as 3 first round picks in this draft, which is 2 more than their current allotment, which would indicate, hey, where are the Bucks going to get those 2 picks? Let's get our windy fingers up. I think it's probably coming from a Giannis deal that they're signaling around the league that it's going to get done here. So then the question is, where are you getting the 2 picks from? How are they being routed together? So Miami certainly has, you know, repeatedly been the you know, leader in the clubhouse in terms of who's the most positioned to make the deal, right? There's been a bunch of discussion about Boston. I think I'm interested in that from the perspective of the Celtics, like, don't leak anything ever. Like, Brad Stevens, you never know what Brad Stevens is going to do until like the press release comes out. So hearing all of the Boston interest, it makes me wonder where that is coming from. Like, who is saying that? And then who benefits from the idea of Boston being involved in it? You know, like those sorts of things that I don't have firm and great answers for. But that's interesting to me. And then, you know, I know that we had up on the screen a little while ago, KOC's note about like the places that where the stars say they want to go or where they don't want to go, sometimes that doesn't wind up mattering, right? Like Kawhi went to Toronto. Paul George went to Oklahoma City, not to the Lakers. You know, Donovan Mitchell going to Cleveland, yeah, so on and so forth. Kyrie, when he was getting out of Cleveland, I think he wanted to go to San Antonio and he wound up in Boston, right? Like
Dame went to Milwaukee, right? Yeah.
Dame going to Milwaukee, right? Great example. And so like there is a possibility here that if the Bucks just hear something they like better, then yeah, maybe Giannis only really wants to extend in Miami, or reportedly would be okay with doing it in Boston. But like, if that's not, if you have a team that is willing to bet on itself in the way that those teams were, saying, let's get the talent in the door and then we'll try to sell him on it once he's here, and they're willing to put together a package that's more enticing or entertaining for the Bucks, like, it doesn't necessarily mean we're down to a 2-horse race just because we're not hearing any loud noises from anywhere else.
So Dan, just for the purpose of exercising this, you know, for the purpose of just a hypothetical exercise, teams that have 2 first round picks in this draft. We've got the Memphis Grizzlies have 3-16. I don't think they're going to be in the Giannis sweepstakes. Chicago Bulls have 4-15. I don't see that happening. Maybe they come in with 3 team deals and they're incorporated in that somehow. But just for the hypothetical, the Atlanta Hawks, interestingly enough, have 8-23. The Dallas Mavericks have 9-30. The Hornets have 14-18. And here's the interesting one: Oklahoma City has 12 and 17. So, I don't know if the Thunder are going to get into the Giannis sweepstakes. I wouldn't count them out. I wouldn't say it's 0%. But if the Milwaukee Bucks feel confident that they're going to get two extra first round picks in this year's draft, maybe they cobble them together from two different teams, a first round from each. But those are the teams that have two first round picks. And if a guy like Giannis Antetokounmpo, a perennial MVP candidate, plays two-way ball, if Wemby is going to be the future of the NBA, I feel like Giannis is as good as anybody to be the Wemby stopper, the Wemby guy that you can throw at him and hope that he's able to be as long and as mobile and as strong to stay with him. Maybe a team like OKC steps up to the plate and puts those two first-round picks into a deal. I would also point out that this is a Miami Heat team that it feels like they're in desperation mode, that they have Bam Adebayo scoring 83 points in a regular season game, and they lost the play-in in heartbreaking fashion when Bam Adebayo went out with an injury. I don't know if that deal is going to be enough, especially if Boston is in play here. It feels like Boston can have a much better deal than the Miami Heat, but it all depends. Your mileage may vary on where, on Hawkes and Tyler Hero. And I don't know if Tyler Hero going back to Milwaukee is a huge part of this, but certainly it's something to note about. A lot's going to happen on Tuesday. I'll be there for the draft show from Yahoo Sports. I'm really excited for this. I also think that I think the Washington Wizards would be making a mistake if they don't draft Cam Boozer number one overall. I think he is the best prospect in this draft. I think it's a mistake that we're doing again with Cam Boozer, potentially if he doesn't go number one overall, that we did this with Luka Doncic and the fact that he doesn't have the athleticism that you would want, the vertical, that he's, slow. The same sort of things we heard about Luka in that draft, and then what we're hearing from Cam Boozer, I just feel like we're making the same mistake. And we have, the Boozer last name and Carlos Boozer, his father. And I feel like second generation players are always subconsciously being graded against and compared to their fathers. We just saw Jalen Brunson, Dan, win the NBA Finals, the most clutch player in a postseason run since Michael Jordan. And a lot of the same sort of low ceiling, high floor descriptions that we're hearing about Cam Boozer that we have with Jalen Brunson, that we have with Luka Doncic, not second gen guy, but similar sort of concerns about Cam Boozer's upside. And I just feel like we need to understand that Cam Boozer, with his assist rate, the skill, the size, I just feel like we're overanalyzing this. And I think it's a mistake if Utah and Washington don't draft Cam Boozer number one or number one and number two. I think he's the clear number one for me. I don't know how much draft stuff you've been doing, but to me, I just wanted to get that out there before Tuesday. Is I feel like Cam Boozer is the head and shoulders number one for me. Just the size, the skill, the shooting, the passing first and foremost to me. When you have a passing big man like that who can shoot and score into the paint, I just feel like he's shown in this postseason run. Yeah, he did not win the NCAA championship. And during the closing moments of that, he did not come out on top. But I would not hold that against him over the long haul. I think Cam Boozer has shown that he has been the best college player last year and the best prospect with that assist rate and the shooting. Just we just never really see that from a guy that size.
Yeah, what I love is that this is shaping up to be like there's the easy sort of division points of, this is eye test versus spreadsheet, right? And say like all of the analytics people that I'm, I'm aware of and following, they're like, oh yeah, Boozer's the number one guy, like no doubt about it. And then your eye test is like, yeah, but have you seen what Darren Peterson's pull-up jumper looks like. You know, it's Kobe in the mid-range. Or, like, have you seen just, like, the ground that A.J. DeBanza can cover? Like, oh, my God. Or DeBanza, I'm sorry. I think I'm saying his name wrong.
Yeah.
Which is maybe the answer to the question of how much draft stuff I've done so far. I'm still learning. I'm learning as we go. But I think the other part of it is, like, all of those things can sort of collapse onto themselves, too. Because, like, I haven't watched much Cam Boozer, but I went out when I watch him. I'm like, I don't think I need too many fancy numbers to think that that guy looks pretty damn good. Or you know, when you look at like the you know the some of the measurables on those other two guys, I'm like, yeah, that feel like that would work in any spreadsheet that we've got. So I don't know. All that to say, this is one of those things where like these are good problems to have, right? If you're Washington, if you're Utah, if you're Memphis, and then to a lesser extent, Chicago and number four, because if somebody drops, then you're happy to have them. But they are still problems. And there's a reason that these guys are, you know, the front offices here, the people, the executives in charge are probably not going to be sleeping a whole hell of a lot between now and Tuesday. Because, yeah, even if you're in the good problems to have component, the part of it, if you wind up picking wrong, that's not going to be a good problem to have anymore. It's going to be one that lingers as you watch the other guy go and make all NBA teams and, you know, lead his team further, especially like teams like Washington and Utah. They expect to hit the gas like now. They feel like they are about to go make a big push now. So, you know, if you back the wrong horse here, that could have pretty long lasting ramifications for you.
Yeah. It's going to be a fun one. I know from a working standpoint, it feels like we're not going to get any breath before the NBA draft comes up and the Giannis sweepstakes comes to a close. But thank you to Jalen Brunson from the Divine family and the Haberstroh family for ending this in five. So we can at least get a few days to do some draft prep and trade prep, right?
Dude, there might be no greater fan of Jalen Brunson at this point and the New York Knicks than my wife, because she roots every year. She just roots for sweeps. She just wants sweeps. And the Knicks gave her two sweeps and a five-game finals. And a five-game finals where I was home in the middle. So, like, it was really, like, this was about as good as it can get from that perspective. And you know, she was very, very grateful, very happy for all that. But, yeah, now a little bit of downtime. We'll see what happens with we're supposed to talk about fresh air, maybe some trees, some aspiration. We'll see what happens with all that. We'll see what happens with Giannis, and we'll see what happens with the draft, and then on into free agency. There's no doubt, no sleep. Everybody on task all the time, Tom, but it's all right. We'd have it no other way.
Yeah, we wouldn't have it any other way. And Mitchell Robinson, if he can't get the money from the Knicks, I'm sure Kawhi Leonard could refer to him some tree planting companies that could help him out. We haven't gotten that either, Dan. The announcement of what the penalty is going to be. So the NBA, the news cycle is going to spin regardless of whether the NBA finals is happening or not. So we'll see. But yeah, this has been an incredible season. And the big number, we've done a lot of shows talking about the statistical probabilities, how good the Thunder were, how good the San Antonio Spurs were, how good the Lakers were when LeBron James was cooking, and then Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves, and how they, all of the storylines. I don't think anything is more shocking than Jalen Brunson and Michael Jordan being the same breath when it comes down to winning a championship and being as clutch as he was. That's just so awesome. It's so cool. Jalen Brunson is now the king of New York and will be for a very long time. So thanks for chronicling it with me on the big number this season. That is a wrap on the 2025-26 NBA season, and we're going to get into the draft free agency going forward. But I would be remiss if I did not mention our amazing production staff behind the scenes, Brad, Sarah, Emmy. You guys, thank you so much. An amazing season, bringing all sorts of new graphics and film onto the show has really augmented everything and made things so easy for us. So thank you, everybody. Make sure you subscribe if you haven't already to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. And we'll talk to you soon. Enjoy the NBA draft next week. I will be on the NBA draft show from Yahoo Sports. Definitely check that out with Kevin O'Connor and company. We're going to have to do a great job. Can't wait for that up in New York. And yeah, Dan, we did it. The Knicks, oh, there it is. The Jalen Brunson How many we got to do that. That is going to be a story. Someone's got to write that story. How many Jaylens were born in the last, 72 hours since the NBA championship that Jaylen has won? Yeah, a lot of clutch scoring from Jaylen. Lots to dive into in the draft on Tuesday. Thank you to everybody. And be sure to have a wonderful and safe weekend here ahead of the draft.